Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Buenas tardes. Buenos medios días. Todavía no son las tardes. Estamos aquí para hablar de un proyecto absolutamente maravilloso. Tenemos aquí la versión en inglés, Lunáticos, Amantes y Poetas, que es un proyecto que representa las nuevas formas de circulación del libro y de la literatura, que encarna un festival como el HEY. La literatura se salió finalmente de las bibliotecas, se salió de los anaqueles de los maestros y empieza a circular en brazos de los lectores casuales, de los oyentes de las historias. Y ese fue un poco el espíritu que animó el trabajo que hicimos Daniel Hahn, el editor en la versión inglesa, y yo, cuando el HEY Cristina Fuentes nos invitó a editar este proyecto, que acabó sumando una gran cantidad de cosas maravillosas. La primera, a los maestros. Cómo abordar a los maestros de una manera creativa y no horrendamente respetuosa. Después, a 12 escritores venidos de las partes más extremas y todos reunidos en el amor común y en una versión absolutamente propia y muy creativa de sus lecturas de los maestros. Y ahora los lectores, que también serán lectores de todo el mundo, de estas nuevas relecturas y de estas nuevas propuestas literarias. Me parece que si bien hemos estado viviendo en los últimos años estos cambios, este libro y la presentación de este libro representa muy bien en un objeto físico, en electrónico, en español y en inglés, los nuevos caminos que tomará la creación literaria, y son caminos, por supuesto, muy sanos y son caminos maravillosos. Y bueno, eso es el HEY y es la razón por la cual estamos aquí reunidos. Los dejo con Daniel Hahn. Y muchas gracias.
Gracias, Margarita. Thank you very much. And good afternoon, everybody. As you may have gathered, the project which we're talking about is a very particular way of celebrating this remarkable anniversary, 400 years of the death of Shakespeare and Cervantes. And as Margarita said, the idea was to find a way of celebrating their work by doing something which is itself creative and expressive and imaginative, which isn't just appreciating their work, but which is creating something new from it. So the HEY Festival and our partners, the British Council and Acción Cultural Española, came up with this idea of commissioning an anthology of stories, 12 short stories by 12 brilliant writers, 6 of them English language writers from around the world, writing stories inspired by Cervantes, it's not the way round you think, and 6 of them Spanish language writers from around the world writing stories inspired by William Shakespeare. We have 12 amazing writers, 2 of whom I'm delighted to say are with me on stage today, Nell Leishen and Deborah Levy. We were very, very pleased that Salman Rushdie wrote an introduction to the book. And this is the first event we're sort of talking about it in public. The book isn't out yet, but it's the first time we get to sort of share a little bit about what we did with you and with people who we hope will read and enjoy the book. I mentioned that there are 2 very important partners involved in this project, Acción Cultural Española and the British Council, and I'm delighted we have representatives from both of those organizations to say a few words today. So please, first of all, welcome the director of Acción Cultural Española, Elvira Marcos.
Buenos días a todos. Muchas gracias, Daniel. Es un honor poder traer aquí parte de Cervantes y de Shakespeare con este proyecto conjunto del British Council, el GEI y Acción Cultural Española, dentro de todo lo que va a ser el 400 aniversario de estos dos grandes autores. Me siento especialmente emocionada por tener aquí a estas dos escritoras que han desarrollado sus relatos y luego hablarán sobre una novela ejemplar de Cervantes como es El licenciado Vidriera, ¿no? Muy, muy interesante. También luego estará Juan Gabriel Vázquez con un relato que se ha inspirado en Julio César hablando también en esta sala. No les quiero aburrir porque lo interesante son ellos, contarles que la edición española estará en breve preparada a cargo de la editorial Galaxia Gutenberg, que la presentaremos también en Bogotá, en la Feria Internacional del Libro, y que por supuesto encontrará también su presentación en España, en Madrid, en la Biblioteca Nacional de España, con la gran exposición que vamos a hacer para rendir homenaje a Cervantes. Y sé que en Colombia también están muy, muy entusiasmados con estos centenarios. Estos días he podido conocer el interés que hay por Cervantes y por hacer actividades aquí. Y nada más, espero que disfruten de este gran libro. Creo que ha sido un reto para estos escritores traer a estos dos genios a nuestros días. Creo que es una forma también de animarnos a leer o a releer a Cervantes y a Shakespeare, que al final yo pensaba pues tratan temas universales que nunca pasan de moda y que son perfectamente aplicables a nuestros días. Nada más. Muchas gracias y enhorabuena.
Gracias. And now I'd like to invite the director of British Council Colombia, Chris Rawlings, to say a few words.
Thank you very much. I've just got a pre-prepared speech of 15 pages, so I'll be brief. Muchas gracias. Gracias al GEI Festival y también a Acción Cultural Española por embarcarse en este proyecto del que nos sentimos muy orgullosos. Si bien British Council está planeando celebraciones desde todas sus áreas, como dijo Daniel, la piedra angular de la forma como lo haremos desde nuestra área de artes es esta aventura literaria en la que 6 angloparlantes responden a Cervantes y 6 hispanoparlantes responden a Shakespeare. No solamente es un honor contar con los textos de nuestros invitados, Nell, Annalation y Deborah Levy, sino además con la edición de Daniel Hahn y Margarita Valencia, y la introducción de Salman Rushdie. Hisham Matar también hace parte de este proyecto, pero desafortunadamente no puede acompañarnos en este momento porque perdió una pelea con su rodilla. Bueno, and if I may also just add at the end in English that we are launching the English edition in London, the London Book Fair, 12th of April, British Library. Entonces, muchas gracias. Chao.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad the lights are back. There was a moment when I thought we were going to have to do this like a radio version of this. There was a moment it was going to be like a nightclub version as well. It changed a few times. I think we've settled. I want to start by asking you both, before we talk about the stories in particular, about Cervantes, who inspired your two stories. Nell, maybe I can ask you first. Do you remember when you first read Cervantes? Was there a moment of discovery for you?
Yeah. I lived in Madrid in my 20s. Before that, I had a career as a film producer and earned lots of money and gave it all up stupidly. Went to Madrid and I read about 3 or 4 books a week. I read everything Kafka wrote. I read Tolstoy. I just was hungry and I was reading and reading. Of course, I was in Madrid, so the time came to pick up Don Quixote. And I think it was a period in my life where I was on input. I was putting all the words into me and the stories and the novels into me. And it's sort of, you need to read if you want to write. It's your apprenticeship in a way. You need to learn to write, but you need to read, and you need to read well. And for me, there was such a deliciousness. I was in Madrid in the boiling heat with these amazing green blinds over the side, reading Don Quixote. And I didn't know at the time, but of course I found out later, I was pregnant when I was reading it. And it was like the whole beginning of my new life. And I remember as I was reading it, I sat down at the table in Madrid, and opposite there were these amazing people from La Movida, incredible people, Almodovar's actors. And it just felt such an extraordinary moment. And I was reading this book, and it was all just so rich. It was just so exciting. And learning about character, about the layers and storytelling.
When we had an event here last night, some of you may have been here, talking about Shakespeare. And we all talked about our favorite Shakespeare plays. And it was interesting that most of us talked sort of, as Nell has just done, autobiographically about why they're our favorite, about that moment of discovering something. Deborah, for you, was there a moment, do you remember your first reading of Cervantes?
Yes. I read Cervantes when I was a theater student, training to write for the theater, not to act. And it was, first of all, a quote from Cervantes that made me read Don Quixote. Too much sanity may be madness. And I thought, that sounds interesting. And I was thinking about that because maybe you know that feeling when you're speaking to someone who's very rigid in their thinking, just wants facts, maybe takes no risks in life. There's that lovely saying from the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, he died of safety. So then I picked up Don Quixote, and in Devon, in the countryside in Britain, the sky was gray, it was raining every single day. You could pick up the whole country and wring it out. And I just lay in bed, I didn't go to lectures, and I read, not all of it, I dipped in and out of the book. And it really did enchant me. The playfulness of the language, the complexity of the composition, it taught me something about how I might begin to approach my first novels, because, you know, the sorts of, Nell mentioned Kafka and other European writers, so the writers who were going to do some quite avant-garde things with the novel, like Marguerite Duras in France or Rob Grier, they wrote short modernist books. And here was this huge, epic story, which was just doing everything you could possibly do. And just one image that stayed with me, 18 years old in Devon, was Don Quixote. He's in full armor, and he arrives in Castile, or Castillo, and he's offered some saltfish. Bocala, you see, and he says, yes, please, I would be grateful. But because he's wearing the armor, he can't, and his hands are so heavy, he can't feed himself. So he draws everyone into his own madness, and they have to feed him the fish. And then the landlord takes pity on him, and he feeds him wine through a straw.
Nell, Deborah said something a moment ago about Quixote kind of setting her up for that first novel. And you described getting something very rich at that moment before you're writing, when you're inhaling things, you're ingesting things. Can you describe, this is probably a difficult thing to do, I suppose, but can you describe what it was you got from it? What it was that, what nourishment you got from reading this thing?
If I'm truly, truly honest, I think the characterization is fantastic, and I got that, and I got the dialogue, but I also got the idea I didn't want to write a book that long, which is a very honest response, because I just remember there's sort of something amazing about very long novels and the immersion in a long novel, but I know it's not me, and it's not my dynamic, it's not how I write. But yeah, it was, And it meanders so much, doesn't it? It's sort of following those paths. I think sometimes we read something and we think, that's not me. Or we read something and we think, ooh, that's a little bit like me. Now, both of those are equally important because we need to know what we're not as well as what we are. I mean, that's how we work, isn't it? You know, as you're growing up, you look at things, and I know I did. I thought, oh, no, I'm not that. So, yeah, it definitely had an effect on me. And I did used to go off to La Mancha on the train from Madrid and sort of exploring, and I'm obsessed with El Greco as well, so I was going looking at all those paintings. But I found something amazing that I don't know, that Cervantes said, which was he would burn every single copy of Don Quixote to have a successful play. Like a really successful play. Isn't that amazing?
I don't believe him. Writers say crazy things.
That's true. Yeah. Writers are always lying. Yeah.
Yes, don't believe anything either
okay,
of these
no,
people
don't
say.
Believe us. Yeah.
Having said something about Quixote as this amazing thing, but also this very large book, this very capacious, complex book, one of the things that was really surprising about the process of commissioning for our anthology was we asked these two people who didn't know each other to write a story inspired by Cervantes. Neither of them chose Quixote as their inspiration. Both of them chose one of the novelas ejemplares, and in fact, they chose the same one. So we have two stories inspired, as Elvira said, by Licenciado Vidriera, which is we call the glass lawyer in English. Deborah, when we asked you to write a Cervantes story of some kind, did you know quickly what it was going to be?
Yes, I'm afraid I did, because you know, we didn't know that we'd chosen the same story until we came here, because the book, the copy of the book I have now, just arrived as I was leaving for the airport. So it's really exciting to read Nell's story and see how she's worked with that original and how different it is actually from my own. Mm. I was teaching writing at the Royal College of Art for some years to visual artists who use text in some way with their work. And I had a research project to cut a very long story short, which Cervantes would never do. I was researching 16th century glass delusions. So in the 16th century, there were men, mostly men actually, who believed that a part of their body was made from glass. So in Venice, there was a man who thought that he was so fragile that he must walk in the middle of the road in case a tile from the roof fell on him and he would shatter. And there was a king in France who believed his inner organs were made from glass, and so he had a rib cage made from iron, which he wore under his clothing in case he would fall. And I was thinking, this is so strange. Wherever the human mind can go, it will go. It can go anywhere. And then my student, I had a student from Prague, Teresa, and I was talking to her about glass delusions, and she said, oh yeah, I had an uncle in Prague who thought he had glass buttocks. And I said, really? He said, yes. So I was getting interested in this, and then I found a true story, which you can find on Wikipedia, and it's just three lines. It's about a Bavarian princess born in, I think, 1826, who believed that she had swallowed a grand piano made from glass. And this story was going to take me in all to all kinds of places. Then I discovered the Cervantes story, The Glass Lawyer, the most beautiful, touching story about a young boy, really an orphan, Thomas, who is adopted by some gentlemen who educate him. And he falls in love. Somebody makes him a love potion and it goes very wrong. And he wakes up delusional and he believes his body is made from glass and is wrapped in straw, and he won't travel in a carriage unless he's covered in something soft.
I said that, Nell, that there are similarities between your stories and the inspiration is the same. But I also happen to know, because you and I had a cup of tea at a certain moment some months ago, that you started with something different. The Glass Lawyer wasn't actually where you started this project.
No, I started somewhere else. I was so happy to be asked to do this. I had a year of illness last year and was very ill. And I was writing the whole year, but I knew it wasn't going to come to anything. I was writing because I can't not write. And this came through like a gift. It was, yes, I can do something. This is something manageable that I can do. And I had been to Madrid the year before and stayed in Alcalá de Henares, where they think Cervantes was born. And there's a beautiful old theater. And I write for theater, and I became very interested in the idea of a couple, delusion within a couple. I was thinking of, you know, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. I started the story. I probably wrote quite a lot of the story, I have to admit. And do you know, something wasn't alive for me. There was, it just wasn't quite alive. So I always listen to that kind of feeling. And I thought, no, there's something else. I thought, okay, let's look through Cervantes, let's start reading some of this stuff. And I came across the short stories, which are like his book, Decameron. He wanted them to be like the Decameron. And I found this story, The Lawyer Made of Glass, and the feeling through my entire body was electric. And I thought, that's it, throw away the other one. So I threw away the 10 pages that I'd been working on. And I was so excited by the story. And I thought, what an amazing thing that if I hadn't been asked by Hay and the British Council to do this story, I would never have written that. I'd never have had the idea. I mean, it's obvious, you know, I wouldn't have looked through those Cervantes stories. I wrote the story, and I thought, it's about me being ill. It's actually about transparency and people seeing me. Because the thing about when you're a very private, proud person and then you're ill, you have to submit your body to other people. And I found that very, very difficult. And so the story was sort of alive and exciting. And then I sent the first draft to you, and I went upstairs, and I keep a writing journal with my ideas in, and I was flicking idly through. 4 years ago, there was an entry, and it said, write about a young girl who is made of glass. I didn't remember writing it. I had no idea that the idea was already inside me. And then just 2 weeks ago, I was sorting through some notes on my phone. You know how you just put notes on your smartphone? And there it said, write about a young girl made of glass. And for me, that was such a fascinating thing, because it's like we do know in a strange way what we don't know what we're doing, but we sort of do, and we just have to trust. But it was this beautiful coincidence that these two things that I had already been thinking about it, I don't know where that idea came from, because I definitely hadn't read the story. But it's the sort of, I like the mysteriousness of that creative process and how I settled on that idea.
You said, before you talked about that coincidence, that there was a moment when, having read the story, you thought, it's amazing, I would never have written this otherwise. And I want to ask both of you about that process of writing specifically to a prompt. I presume, Deborah, there is a difference in terms of the kind of creative energy in a piece of writing between something which is entirely from yourself and something which is where someone else gives you parameters and says, play
Definitely.
In this particular area.
Yes. The commission, I'm sorry. Okay, can you hear me? The commission was a chance to bring all my thinking together in prose and create a voice for this princess, this true story. I had to reimagine her, and a doctor, a physician, who I had to imagine. And for this story, I researched 19th century physicians, and one of them really took my imagination because he had sold his meat-eating teeth to fund his studies. But there was something else that happened. So here I was, for this anthology, looking at the story of a young woman who imagines that she's swallowed a grand piano made from glass, something very big. But around that time, my young daughter, had come back from school, and she didn't look very happy, and she said that she had, the expression in English is a lump in her throat. What is that in Spanish? A lump in the throat. She said it felt very real, that her throat was hurting. So after talking about this, it turned out that she was being bullied at school, and we sorted it out, and the lump in her throat disappeared. So the lump was everything that was not said. It was anxiety. It was all sorts of things. But what interested me is that it actually had a shape. It was a lump. It was something that she felt was in her body. So in English, there are many phrases a bit like that. Butterflies in our stomach, a flutter when we feel nervous, or a thorn in our side when somebody is like, poking us, wants to make us feel small, a frog in our throat when you need to clear your throat. So this was all in the language anyway.
Would you read a little bit for us, Deborah, from your story?
Certainly, thank you. The story is told by the physician, by the doctor, and I'll just read two pages. It's called The Glass Woman. The year is 1849, and yet your lips will not be so very different from my lips, and the revolutions in your century will not be so different from ours. But now I must take a breath, and you must too, and with this breath, which I still have not taken, I will speak to you from where I am now, which is Bavaria. Bavaria, 1849. I am observing a young woman of 23 years in age. She is an aristocrat. I am a physician. I am observing catastrophic poetry of her body. The month is August, it is past midnight, and she is walking sideways with great difficulty down the corridors of the royal palace, her arm stretched in front of her as if she is afraid she will fall. Her green eyes are wide open as she makes her way to her chamber. Something is wrong with Princess Amelia Alexandra. On the 14th of July, she demanded that all the furniture in the palace be covered in soft velvet, and that no person should sit next to her on the dining table, not on the right, not on the left. And she announced she would no longer be able to ride her horse, and if she was to travel in a carriage, it must be lined with straw. When questioned by her royal parents, the princess finally confessed that when she was a child, she'd swallowed a grand piano made from glass. Consequently, because of her imagined shape and fragility, she is fearful that if she knocks into anything at all, or trips over her skirts, or if one of the royal dogs jumps into her lap, the glass piano inside her will shatter and she will become a terrifying tangle of flesh and glass.
Thank you. Nell, when you hear Deborah reading and when you read the story, there are obviously things that they have in common, your stories, which aren't only, if you like, they aren't only narrative things. They aren't only because the influence is the same. Do you recognize some kind of sympathy of tone or of purpose when you hear these together?
When I very first heard that we'd done the same story, there was obviously a little prickle of concern. I thought, oh gosh, is that okay? I cannot tell you what joy it has given me that we did the same. And I absolutely love the two stories together. They're so different, but I think thematically, there's something that I think we're both exploring about young women being looked at, about the male gaze looking at young women. Because I think for young women to go through pubescence and to develop, it's a very difficult time, because what you're actually going to enter is the world of the male gaze. And every woman in this audience is going to know exactly what I'm talking about, that you become the object. And I think that was something that really, really interested me. And the other thing that I think is that every young woman who reaches pubescence has to face the fact that they're going to, if they have sexual contact and get pregnant, they have to give birth. And these are really frightening, scary things. And I loved the fact that we had some of those things in common in our stories. I really loved it, yeah.
And the opposite of that too, because something that interests me about fragility and vulnerability, and maybe we know this from our families, is that if there is somebody who's vulnerable in our family, in fact, they are not powerless, they're very powerful, because they need a lot of attention.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I'm looking at the way that she uses this body dysmorphia to gather to her some attention.
No, I think that's right.
So and at one point, of course, I don't want to give the story away, because I hope that you will read it. But if we have a piano inside her, which is an instrument of communication, I wanted her to play her piano, that is to express herself, without fearing that she will shatter.
But I think that's something that we were both interested in, is female silence and when a woman can speak. And, you know, the young women, both of our young women, have problems with communicating, with speaking of themselves. You know, this is a very febrile moment in a young woman's life. And how do you get the guts to speak out? How do you get the guts to be, to have your own agency, you know, and perform in the world? And I think it's something very interesting. I personally keep coming back to this age of people. I find it fascinating. I do love teenagers.
Will you read a little from
yours
now?
I will. So I've picked from halfway through. So I have a young, very unusual young woman who lives on a farm miles from anywhere. And she gets the bus into school every day, and she's tiny. She's very, very small. But then, I'll just give you the little line where it happens. One morning... I take off my night clothes to put on my day clothes, and I see the changes. Where there was once arid land, there is growth. I grow a copse under each arm, a copse between the legs. Deposits of fat begin to appear. I soften. I grow two small hills on my chest. I am becoming a landscape. The river water is blood. And this is a girl who is so tied up with her landscape where she lives, actually similar to Mary in The Color of Milk, the book that I wrote about another 15-year-old girl. Now, she goes to school, and there's a young man one day comes in, very unusual young man, and he says, "What are you reading?" And he says, "I read that book, it's really good." And it's this incredible moment of, oh my gosh, I'm a reader, you're a reader, we can connect over this. And then he goes and tells her she's pretty. And she's completely thrown. She runs away, she runs home. And then she thinks she's made of glass. So she's in bed. In her bedroom, she won't come out. When I wake, I look at the window. The leaves have slipped from the trees. The windowsill outside my room is white. It is thick with snow. My breath emerges from my mouth in clouds. I have lost time. I lift a hand, glass, glass, glass. I did not dream it. I hear something in the room. Slight click of knees, air exhaled as a body adjusts itself. The creak of a chair, and then silence. I don't look, I won't. I look instead at the white landscape of the wall, look up at the ceiling, the land of crack and cobweb. My mind is active, thrum, thrum, my skull is warm with thoughts. There is a movement from the chair. I turn my head towards the center of the room and I see him. His hair has been cut. I can see his two eyes. They are so pale, so large and pale that the pupils are specks of dirt. What are you doing here? I ask. My voice is fragile, has the tone of a finger flicking glass, has the tone of a wet finger run around the top of glass, has the tone of a glass girl. You've been asleep for a long time, he says. I know. I pull the covers up to my chin in case he can see my glass skin. I don't want you here, I say. He shrugs, the only movement in the room. What you want doesn't interest me. He is sitting, has a stillness which is uncommon. His hands sit in his lap, obedient. Do you know what has happened to me? I ask. He nods. You have turned into a girl made of glass. I stare at him. It's true, isn't it? It's what you say, therefore it's true. We stay like that for a while. I am under the covers and he sits. Then he speaks. Your mother says you aren't eating. I feel myself under the covers. Sharp edges, cool, smooth surfaces. I am empty. Your mother says you won't drink. He brings out a stone flask, a flagon. He pulls out a wide cork, pours the contents into a glass. I brought you this. I look at it. It is liquid, tinged green with small floating particles. It's from the river, he says. He stands, lifts the water, and holds it to my lips. I hear the glass hit my glass lip, hear it clink. I shrink backwards into the pillow. You'll break me, I say. I won't. Drink. He tips the glass and the first drops go into my lips, into my mouth. I can taste the bed of the river, the gravel and the weed. I can taste the skin of a trout. He waits until I have drunk as much as I can, then takes the glass away. He places it on the table. Fresh snow has begun to fall against the window. It lands in silent slumps. My breath is clouded. Dark comes. I ask if he is going home, but he says nothing. His eyes are closed. He sleeps. I pull down the covers and pull up my nightdress. I see my glass legs. I pull my clothes up further, see my glass pelvis, the hip bones. I see through my belly into the cavity, see the cave womb and the unfurled bracken stalks which hold my eggs. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you think, now, we talk sort of casually about Shakespeare as the kind of the father of, the grandfather of English writing, and about Cervantes as the grandfather of Spanish writing. But in some ways, what's the most interesting is that they aren't limited to influence on a language or influence on a single culture, but their influence is transnational and translingual. And you are both inspired for these stories by someone who has been dead for 400 years and wrote in a different language. And I wonder, Nell, whether there is something that must be universal about art to make it survive. I mean, whether the universality is one of the distinguishing factors of the sort of art that lives for hundreds and hundreds of years.
It just keeps living and living. Yeah, I think it contains archetypes. It contains things we understand. And I always remember reading about Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice. In Indian villages, they absolutely love Jane Austen because, of course, their caste system is exactly like our class system was. And, you know, people are very smart. They're able to transform something and sort of apply it to their culture. It doesn't have to need to be culturally specific. There is writing that's culturally specific and time specific. And I think that's probably one of the big things, is if it belongs to a particular epoch, then
I think that for me, the art that what makes a piece of art live on is that it has some mystery in it that I can't quite comprehend, but want to reach, but it reaches to me and makes me want to makes me want to discover more. So it's not art that explains everything, it's art that has left some holes in it.
I felt after the Shakespeare conversation last night, I just went away and I thought, gosh, I've got to read them all again. It's that, isn't it? And it's when I was looking at this as well, it's like, oh, Don Quixote, of course I'd bring a different self to it. And now I need to go and read all the other stuff. And now, of course, I need to read the plays. So, yeah, I think it's stuff you're right. It's stuff you never tire of, isn't it, that you can just keep going back to. Like a Chekhov short story, you can just keep reading.
Well, we're talking about Shakespeare and Cervantes, but what you say also makes me think, as I'm sure you all know, David Bowie died a couple of weeks ago. One of the things that people did in response, when the news came out, everyone suddenly went back and listened to their favorites again and reminded themselves of the things they hadn't heard in a long time and sort of re-examined the stuff that was never quite, I suppose, to reassure themselves that that was still there and that wasn't going to die. Do you think, Deborah, it makes sense then to I suppose we can't anticipate what's going to survive, we can't second guess what's going to survive, but there is a way of thinking about the art that's being produced now. This could apply to your own writing as well. But yeah. Thinking about what are the qualities that make it not just make you want to read them again and again and listen again and again, but people who are 200, 400 years from now with quite different sensibilities and quite different cultures still find something in whatever it is that survives.
Well, Bowie, I'm speaking about Bowie tonight, so I won't say very much, except that for me, growing up, sort of 12, 13 in London, Bowie, like the great artist that he is, opened up some imaginative possibilities that really are inside all of us anyway. They're all there. They just need to someone a little bit enchanted to sprinkle their dust, to make them shine in the sky. So for me, Bowie, it was, what is a man, what is a woman, what is masculinity, what is femininity? He spoke through so many personas.
It's also, sorry to interrupt you, it's revealing that it's all questions, not answers.
Yes.
But all the things you talk about getting from this.
Exactly.
And this is probably true about
about
Shakespeare and Cervantes. It's about the questions that are being asked.
Absolutely about questions. And the personas that he spoke through. So a persona, I think, is the Greek for the mask through which we speak. He gave us the possibility of speaking with our bodies in fashion and in his lyrics. There's a star man waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet you. And you say, oh yes, please come and please come and meet me.
We have a little over 10 minutes for you to ask questions or make comments, so I will invite you to just give us a wave, just put your hand in the air, and I think we have microphones we will send you. So if you have something you would like to ask or comment, someone has to be brave and ask the first question. There is someone there about halfway back. If you wave as vigorously as you can, please. Thank you. The microphone's just coming to you.
Is it possible to read even a little bit of the Cervantes story, even the first page?
I don't think we have the Cervantes story with us, but it's easy to find.
I understand. I just wanted to hear the language.
Yeah, that would be really nice. Sorry. Should have thought of that. Sorry.
We should have thought of that.
Yeah.
I blame them, obviously.
Yeah.
They should have thought of that. It was completely not my fault.
No.
I can't believe you didn't think of that.
Terrible.
That's a good idea. Thank you. Another question, please. Let's see any hands.
Yeah.
Elvira, right in front. If you just wait for the microphone, please. Right in the front row.
You were talking before when you discovered Cervantes, that you read it when you were young. I think Nell was talking about that. What do you think? Do you think Cervantes is something we should read when we are 14, 15, or...
Sorry.
We should read it when we are older.
So it's about kind of when is the ideal time to discover Cervantes? Would you recommend, like, for a teenager to read Cervantes, or do you need to be older to read him?
I don't think there should be any set rules about discovering anything. My rule with my children was always give them stuff slightly too old for them. And then the excitement of that, the sort of transgression of that, turned them into these amazingly avid readers. So I would sort of put a book in their room and just say, oh, you might be interested. And they'd come down and go, oh my God, Mum, do you know what was in that book? And I'd go, no. Of course I knew. But I think you can come back to Cervantes or Shakespeare time and time and time again. But I think there's something magical about reading this stuff young. And I would like to have read it much younger. I think reading young does something, and then you can come back to it later on. I think a lot of the time we're reading stuff when we're young. We don't understand what it is we're reading, but that's okay. I remember that lovely feeling of not understanding everything, you know, of there being secrets, and me thinking, oh, I'm not there yet, you know. I mean, still not with a lot of stuff.
Thinking about that not quite understanding, but beginning to kind of find things in something. Are you tempted, Nell? I mean, is there a part of you that wants to read this in Spanish? Because I know that you, I assume, both read this book in the English translation. Is there a part of you which thinks...
Don Quixote,
there's still something waiting for you to find.
Yeah. I find reading in translation quite problematic because I'm a writer, I'm always looking for the writer's word choice. So the joy of reading Deborah's story and knowing that those were her exact decisions, there's something very amazing for me. It's like I'm sort of in her head, and I loved the story so much, and I could sort of see the choices on the page she was making, whereas if I read in translation, you know, I'm not sure whose choices those are, and I'm such a purist about writer's choices. It's just the way that I am.
I'd like to see Don Quixote on the syllabus for English teenage kids. Mm. Why not? Amazing. Mm. They would, you know, if you're going to read a big book like Harry Potter, my girls now are reading Elena Ferrante. But they kind of grew up on big epic books. Mm. And so I think to put Quixote there and to get into this wonderful friendship, actually, between two men, that's something we haven't talked about. It's also a book about friendship and accepting all the flaws and weaknesses and enjoying each other's humor and indeed you know, we have Pancho going dictating letters to his wife, I think too, how shall I write this sentence, and all that stuff about friendship I think is very important.
But as Nell said, it's you also then need to keep coming back and coming back to these things, to a book like Quixote, because even though there are those things that a teenager might connect to very strongly, the things that you'll get from it when you are in your 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s will be different. Mm. It assumes certain kinds of knowledge, for example, that you may not have. And so you either need to read it later or you have to kind of keep refreshing your relationship with a book like that.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question.
While you're taking the microphone, I just want to say it is a beautiful anthology, and it is an amazing object. And actually, without the scheme, these stories wouldn't exist. And I just think it's fantastic. I just wanted to say that, really. I'm not talking about my own story. I'm just talking about the beauty of the anthology as a whole. And it's such a shame Hisham Attar isn't here. His story is so fantastic.
Danny, wonderful. Who was our editor.
Yeah. It was really, it was a wonderful experience to write it. Yeah, more please.
There's a question here in front.
Well, thank you. I think it's very difficult to try to see from a perspective or today's perspective to interpret two big, the main writers since the Renaissance like Shakespeare and Cervantes. And I would like a comment on how you see a little bit the soul of both writers. I think it was Harold Bloom who said that Shakespeare taught us how to speak with ourselves, whereas Cervantes taught us how to speak with each other. And I would like to see what is your reflection on this comment.
So it's the question about the kind of different souls of these writers and their writing. The quote from Harold Bloom, I think it was, that Shakespeare taught us how to communicate with ourselves, Cervantes, how to communicate with each other. So it's a question about the essences
between
of these
soliloquy
characters.
And dialogue, in a way, isn't it? Because what Shakespeare does so extraordinarily are these amazing soliloquies that remind me of Philip Larkin's poetry. And it really is a sort of, let's go through all these layers and let's start to excavate and let's start mining and digging up all this stuff and what it is to be a human being. I think that's amazing. And really, Cervantes, it's the dialogue, and it is that amazing energy from the dialogue that drives the story, actually, and from the characters.
It's odd that you say that, actually, because one might have thought the person who is principally a playwright would be the person who is able to animate.
Yeah, but that's why his plays were never satisfactory for him, because actually someone who can write Don Quixote isn't a playwright. I was talking about Henry James the other day. I can tell Henry James isn't a playwright, because what you need to be a playwright is you need extreme tension, and you need to understand you've got a certain period of time in which events are going to happen, and you need objectives, and every single line needs to count. It's an incredibly rigorous craft, and always has been.
I think what Shakespeare and Cervantes share is a historical and psychological grip on their subject matter that is really impressive. But all writers, if I understand the question, have a number of conversations going on in the writing. So then there's the subjectivity of the character. You could call that a conversation with yourself. But in fact, subjectivity means how we experience something in our mind. So there you will have point of view. And both writers are so good at that. And then there is a broader conversation, a larger, maybe more historical conversation, more political conversation, where you're chasing your arguments in a fiction and putting them into the mouths of your characters. So writers will have many types of conversation, even in a short fiction. I think perhaps the influence of Cervantes on my story, The Glass Woman, is something to do with a kind of, it's quite a long short story, in fact, and it has a sort of epic feel, even though it's a conversation between two people. I think that he made the world of he helped me make the world of the story bigger in some strange way.
I think in Shakespeare, I mean, if you're writing for the Globe and you're writing a play of that vast size, it is an act of madness, because you're basically dividing thinking, everything that you think, up into maybe 18 to 24 characters. And you're actually, it's like a big prism, and you're looking at the world through all those 18 to 24 different points of view. I think that's why playwriting so hard, you know, to keep that all balanced all the way through.
Deborah mentioned something about, you used the word conversations that writers are having, even within its individual pieces of writing. But obviously what we're talking about here is also conversations between writers and the ways in which writers can talk to each other, even across very great distances of time and language. And I just wanted to end with a question about, I suppose, how writers learn from other writers. And we sort of talked about what is amazing about Cervantes and about Shakespeare, but I'm curious, as someone who doesn't write very much myself, about that process of how you actually learn from other writers, whether it's a kind of conscious and a deliberate thing of studying what they do and thinking yes. about it, and to what extent it's sort of what Nell described when she was feeding her brain in Spain, where it's a matter of taking stuff in and it just kind of percolates on its own.
I think the hardest thing to do in a novel and in a short story is to handle time, how time passes through the novel, how time passes through the short story. So you see, I start in 1849, with a physician. He's taken a breath, and he needs to take another breath. You know, he wants to tell the story very quickly. But how time passes is what I look to other writers to learn more about. Because that's what all writing is, how to handle time. And you will see in Shakespeare how he telescopes time backwards and forwards. And you also see how in Cervantes he suggests events that are going to happen and regrets events that haven't happened yet. So he's juggling with time. And the best writer, muse and my best professor, is the French writer Marguerite Duras, who she's like the Einstein of time in her books, and she has much to teach me.
I've got the same obsession with how to handle time, and in fact I'm just writing a play about time being circular, that time never moves forward, it's just circular and it just keeps going so nobody ever dies, which is super entertaining. But when I'm reading, I'm terrible. I just used to, reading was the love of my life, and I would read walking around London in the streets like this. I don't know why I never died. I would just read the whole time, and now I can't get that deliciousness. It's very hard because I'm so aware of everything, and I'm just analyzing everything still. You know, oh yeah, that's how they did time. Oh, that's how they shift that. Oh, speech marks like that. And it's just sort of, you need everything as much into making this amazing stew as possible.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to say that, talking about the passage of time, we are out of time. Please join me in thanking Nell Eichmann and Deborah Lee.
Thank you. Thank you.